Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. Welcome, and I think it's not so far into the month that I can't say Happy New Year to all. Welcome, Vice Chair George. We have two main items on our agenda for today. First, we have an informational meeting on loan modifications under Senate Bill 628, and we also have a work session on Legislative Concept 29 and Legislative Concept 53, which are our two committee bills for the February supplemental session. We are going to actually reverse the orders and do the work session first because some of our members will not be able to stay through the entire time. So I'm going to open a work session, and what we have before us is Legislative Concept 29 and Legislative Concept 53. Both of these should be at least somewhat familiar to the committee members. We have discussed both of these issues in prior committees. Legislative Concept 29 increases the annuity coverage for the sale of annuities in Oregon, and there is attached to the draft a summary from the Department of Consumer and Business Services and Insurance Division Administrator about this increased insurance protection for annuities. Legislative Concept 53 is a bill dealing with automatic renewal provisions and free trial offers in consumer contracts. It also deals with early termination fees for cancellation of consumer contracts, and there is a summary of that as well. So those are our two committee bills, and I will entertain a motion for introduction of those two as committee bills.
Madam Chair, I move that we accept LC 29, LC 53 as committee bills.
Vice Chair George moves that we introduce Legislative Concept 29 and Legislative Concept 53 as committee bills. Any discussion?
I just need to file the standard disclaimer that I will be voting to do this, but that doesn't mean I will support the bill.
I appreciate that. Senator Girard makes the usual disclaimer. We are introducing these as committee bills. It does not indicate support or non-support of either concept at this time. So any objection other than the one noted? Okay. Legislative Concept 29 and Legislative Concept 53 are now introduced. And I will close the work session on those legislative concepts and open up an informational meeting on loan modifications under Senate Bill 628. Many of you remember we spent several hours in the 2009 session with Senate Bill 628 dealing with foreclosure. Senate Bill 628 is the bill that requires a change to the notice that goes to homeowners in foreclosure with an opportunity for them to request loan modification and have a meeting with their lender if they so request. Must be with someone authorized to be able to modify the loan. And what we've done is today invited several different parties to come and talk to us about how that is being implemented, some of the things that are happening out there with the homeowners. Part of the bill also was to use some of the funds from the Department of Justice. They had a settlement fund from a case that was settled, and part of that fund went to additional housing counselors, and that's part of the testimony we'll hear today is from some of the housing counselors. And so first, to give us an overview of the legislation from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we invite back to our committee Lou Savage, Senior Policy Advisor, Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. As the Chair said, I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The Chair actually gave a pretty good opening summary of the bill, and given my voice, I think I'll make my comments fairly brief. As the Chair noted, there was actually a bill in the 2008 session which required additional notice to a homeowner about their rights and possible options. And this notice goes with the foreclosure packet that homeowner gets if there's a trustee foreclosure. And the 2009 bill added some provisions to that. It required that the lender or really the trustee send a form to the homeowner giving them the opportunity to request a loan modification. And if the homeowner wants a meeting with the lender or loan servicer, that that request needs to be honored. It can be a in-person meeting or it can be a telephone meeting. There are some timelines that the bill requires for responding to the request for a telephone or an in-person meeting. There are also timelines for the lender to respond to the homeowner if there is a request for a loan modification. The homeowner has 30 days to return a request for a loan modification to the lender or loan servicer. The loan servicer or lender has 45 days to act on that request. During that 45-day period of time is the period when the meeting, if it's requested, needs to take place, either by telephone or in person. The bill has not been in effect long enough for, at least for our agency, to determine how this process is going. We are hopeful that the loan modification company, the loan servicers and the lenders are complying with the law. We believe they are. There is a form which I've attached to my testimony, which we promulgated through rule, which lenders and loan servicers are using to comply with the law. And as you can see, it incorporates both the requirements of the 2008 session and the requirements for the 2009 session bill as well. The process itself, although we're hopeful that a lot of loan modifications will take place, has an additional benefit, and that is that a borrower who is in distress will know what their options are after they request a loan modification. They'll know whether, in fact, they'll be able to stay in their home or possibly stay in their home, or whether, based on their income and resources, there really is not an opportunity to do that, and they can make whatever plans or explore what other options might be available to them. So we are anxious to hear how the industry is making this bill work. We know that the resource issue was one that the lenders identified initially with respect to responding to requests for loan modification. Because of the bulk of requests that were coming in and the economic circumstances that many people were in, there was quite a bit of pressure on lenders and loan servicers to respond to requests, and we're hopeful that those requests are being processed in a timely manner. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Savage? Questions?
I have one, just a brief one.
Senator Durham.
What do you estimate the cost of this bill was to the agency?
To the agency, minimal, very minimal, because the only responsibility we had was to promulgate the rule which put into place the notice itself.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll spare you with that. Hope you feel better. Next, we're going to hear from John Bartholomew with Osberg and Liesl Wendt with 211 information on some of the outreach activities that they've been doing out in the communities to let homeowners know what their options and rights are. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair Bonamici, Vice Chair George, members of the Senate Consumer Protection Committee, thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony on the state of foreclosures in Oregon. My name is Jonathan Bartholomew. I work for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. Today I'm going to provide a little bit of information on the current levels of foreclosure in Oregon and nationally and the trends where things are going. Also provide a little feedback on what we're hearing from homeowners facing foreclosure in Oregon and make some suggestions on what we think can help keep more people in their homes. I've submitted statements to you from several homeowners who shared their stories with me about how it's been dealing with their lenders in trying to get a loan modification, and several of them are here today and are interested in talking with you after the hearing if you have any time. They've traveled from Bend, Medford, and Portland to share their stories, make sure they're heard, and hopefully, you know, if you have time to meet with them, that would be wonderful. Last year, the legislature passed Senate Bill 628 with a goal to increase the likelihood that lenders will provide more loan modifications to homeowners facing foreclosure. And this bill dovetails with the federal HAMP program, which provides incentives to loan servicers to modify home loans and create standards for who must be offered modifications. However, the national trend and the Oregon outlook are both very disappointing. Nationally, the mortgage delinquency rate and foreclosure rates are on the increase. Here in Oregon, the picture is the same. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association, Oregon mortgages that are delinquent or are in foreclosure as of the end of the third quarter of 2009 have nearly doubled since 2008, from 5.2% to 9.4%. And this exceeds the high point of 7.7% from the 1980s recession. And we're not at the peak of foreclosures, according to the experts. Most analysts expect foreclosures to peak either late this year or early next year. Now, the reasons for the increased rate of foreclosure are varied, but many of the direct reasons, such as unemployment, underemployment, a lagging economy, have their roots in the risky lending practices and of the banks and commodification of mortgages. Wall Street's gambling with mortgages, with homes, created a domino effect that then led to higher unemployment, home loans defaulting that never should have been at risk in the first place. So the first question is how HAMP is working nationally, and the news is not very good. According to reports from the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, in December, only about 4% of trial modifications have been converted to permanent modifications. And there's a wide disparity between the companies that are providing this. For example, GMAC Mortgage has made permanent modifications to about 11% of their eligible customers, while Bank of America has made permanent modifications to one out of every 10,390 eligible customers. Nationwide, that's 98 customers that Bank of America has made permanent modifications for out of over 1 million eligible customers. The Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 628 with a goal to bring homeowners and lenders together to discuss viable loan modifications and hopefully reduce the number of foreclosures. So is that helping? Well, due to the time frame of the implementation of 628, it is difficult to determine with certainty if there's an at this time if there's an increase in the number of trial modifications offered. But my office and Our Oregon both reached out to homeowners facing foreclosure and found the following. The form that lenders send to homeowners under 628 does not clearly explain that they have a right to a meeting to discuss loan modification. Many people are likely to not know what this form is really for. Some people have said they haven't received it. Some people say they received it a week later from another company. And one of the most important components of this law is the right to a meeting, but the instructions for requesting the meeting are not clear. The notice should be improved to give much more detail on the homeowner's rights and what the lender needs to do. We're universally hearing from people going through foreclosures that the banks are unresponsive at best and sometimes even downright hostile. For example, we had one homeowner, Karen in Gold Hill, was told that every time she calls, they're put at the bottom of the list for consideration for a loan modification. And that's just not true, but they're telling her that kind of thing. Lenders claim that they haven't received documents the homeowners have sent multiple times, or it takes months for them to be filed. Nicole in Springfield reported, One time I had to send a fax to update some financial information, and it took them five weeks for them to enter that they had received the fax. Lenders provide different answers regarding qualification, different instructions, and appear to be reviewing different files each time a homeowner calls. Paula in Portland was told by one Bank of America specialist to stop making payments. When she called 2 days later, the new specialist told her to make payments. Donna in White City was given a verbal loan modification offer in November, then got a call back on December 28th saying the deal was off and her account has been turned over to a collections agency, no explanation given. Poor communication from lenders, such as not sending materials, giving people the runaround when they call, and not calling when they say they will, is another thing we're seeing a lot of. One interesting story is from Tanya in Bend, who is here today, and can flesh this out more after the hearing if you wish. She was given a verbal agreement over the phone in September and was told that she would be receiving the materials to sign. A couple weeks later, started getting calls from the bank saying, where's the signed documents? Well, they had never sent the signed documents. So they followed up, the homeowners followed up multiple times asking for the materials to be sent. Well, finally, on December 11th, she received the loan modification offer forms to sign. They were dated November 23rd and said she was supposed to send them in by November 1st. I'm not sure how that works in reality, but on top of all of the time frame issues, the details weren't the same as what she was told over the phone. So you get different stories from different people. The paperwork changes. Another story is from Lisa in Portland, who is also here today. She called Wells Fargo in October and was told she was approved for a trial modification for October, November, and December. However, she hadn't received any paperwork. She called back later to have them fax the paperwork. None came. She calls back, gets a different person, tells her, no, you haven't been approved for a loan modification, and won't tell her why. Since then, she's been told by several different people at Wells Fargo different reasons why they say she's ineligible for modification, also that her application is still in process, and just yesterday she received a notice that no, she's not going to get a loan modification, and no explanation given why. We've heard similar stories from Nicole in Springfield, Ann in Portland, Karen in Gold Hill, Donna in White City, Charlotte in Portland, Stuart in Tigard. These are just a few of the people that we've talked to all across the state who are facing significant problems with communication with the banks. None of these issues are resolved by Senate Bill 628. There seems to be too much power in the hands of lenders, as the lenders can deny a loan modification request based on saying the homeowner didn't send the paperwork, even if the homeowner says they sent it several times. Ironically, many of these loans were provided with no documentation from the homeowner in the first place, and now the lenders demand excessive documentation from the homeowners to avoid foreclosure. One suggestion I would like to make to improve the situation is to follow the recommendations of the National Consumer Law Center, which I included in my written testimony. I put the executive summary in there. Which requires lenders operating under signed HAMP agreements to prove that they are fully complying with the HAMP guidelines when they don't approve a loan modification. They need to basically show their work, like when you were in high school, math class, and you weren't allowed to just write down, oh, it's 3C. You had to show the work of how you got there. This way, if the homeowner sees the lender is not using accurate information to deny their loan request, the homeowner should have some recourse for reconsideration. It makes it so lenders must be honest about their calculations, as they know they will be held to HAMP requirements. It gives the state an opportunity to see if the program is working and if there's room for improvement. And like I said, it gives the homeowners that opportunity to correct errors that the lender may have made. And it's a simple fix. It doesn't cost anything and is not a major policy change. Senate Bill 628 was a step in the right direction, but as with many important issues, this is solving this problem is a process. I urge this committee to consider improvements to Senate Bill 628 so that more Oregonians can stay in their homes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And we'll hear also from Lisa Wendt from 211, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'm with an organization called 211 Info, which provides health and human service information and referral through several different phone numbers, primarily 1-800-SAFENET as it relates to the foreclosure project that I'll talk about. First, just some background. 211 is a nonprofit agency that provides people with free and easy access to community health and human service answers. We operate 211, an FCC-designated phone number for health and human service information and referral. And last year referred over 100,000 people to different resources, including food stamps, immunizations, and increasingly foreclosure, which I'll talk about today. We were involved in the foreclosure project through the use of 1-800-SAFENET on various outreach materials that were used by the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. So today what I was going to do is talk about who we've referred, how they're hearing about the service, and from Osberg, really let you know some of the questions and common issues that have come out from some of those callers. We began providing the service in April of 2008. Prior to that, we'd only had 2 foreclosure calls, just to give some perspective about what the needs were prior to that time. Primarily, what we're doing is connecting people who are calling to HUD-certified counseling experts, so we're really the connector in the process. Often people are calling us who are seeking perhaps food assistance, energy assistance, often calling for mortgage assistance, similar to rent assistance, and during that opportunity we'll let them know about HUD-certified counseling programs that are available in their area. Oftentimes what we also do when people call is let them know what they need to prepare as they're going to go to one of these agencies and or what they need to have on hand when they call their lender. So what are people calling for? Over 1,750 people have called either SafeNet or 211 since April 2008, seeking mortgage or foreclosure assistance services. We had almost 1,000 searches on our online directory looking for foreclosure assistance. 2/3 of those callers were calling for foreclosure assistance, and the remainder third were in default already. Just this past quarter, we had 411 calls, and of those, 63 spoke Spanish. So the Spanish-speaking calls have increased over the course of the project. And how they heard about the resource, primarily they've heard about it from a letter from a bank, a lender, a mortgage company, followed by members of Congress. So they've called a member of Congress seeking help, and they've been referred back to us. I did include a copy of the foreclosure flyer, which also has the phone number on it, and has been distributed through social service agencies, Department of Human Services, legal aid, et cetera. So that's another way that people have found out about the service. The vast majority of people who are calling have lost their job, and that puts them in the situation where they're seeking additional help. Illness and interest rate changes are the second and third reasons that people are calling. Often, over the course of the conversation, we've really come to realize it's often a combination of those two issues, loss of a job and perhaps illness, preventing someone from going back to work the same number of hours they were working before. The unique piece about Oregon SafeNet is that we're also able to offer people referrals to other social services. And not surprisingly, these are people who've not sought services before, so they're not aware of different pieces of the safety net that might be able to help them, or they've given to those agencies before. So it's a moment of seeking a safety net that you've been a volunteer at or you've donated to, and now you're asking for services for, which has been a challenge. So over 1,400 referrals were given to other services such as food stamps, utility assistance, legal aid help, etc. I wanted to share a couple anecdotes from people who have called us. And again, just to reiterate, many callers are unfamiliar with being in the situation they're in, seeking help, and the challenges of navigating the system. One family had a reduction in income due to a decrease in hours. The father was the person who called. He was looking for answers to questions about loan modification. His bank had sent him some paperwork to request a modification. He had done so. He called back after waiting 2 months since he'd submitted the paperwork and couldn't get a response from anyone at the bank to where his application was in the process. He had expressed frustration and was scared it will take the bank too long and then he would end up being in default. He was given referrals to a HUD-certified counseling agency as well as other social service referrals to help meet his basic needs. Another caller actually called seeking basic needs assistance. It was a couple who made just over the amount to be eligible for food stamps, but they'd had a reduction in their income, and they were forced between choosing to pay their mortgage or buy food. So they were given referrals to food banks, community basket programs, and then offered resources about HUD-certified counseling agencies with the recommendation to begin to look into those services sooner than later. The majority of callers expressed anxiety about how to deal with the situation they're in, and another consistent theme was trying to engage their lender but having trouble getting a hold of anyone and getting clear and consistent information from their lender. Most recently, we partnered with the City of Portland and Acorn to do an additional marketing campaign about services and outreach to folks in the Portland metro area, particularly in zip codes highest hit with foreclosures. And what we've learned from both projects, both the statewide project and the local one, is it's a new type of caller who's calling us. Giving food box referrals along with loan counseling illustrates how desperate people are. As one staff in the call center said, I'm imagining someone trying to make sense of a loan modification while also coordinating picking up enough food boxes to stretch to the end of the month. Not surprisingly, there's much shame and denial in reaching out for help. Homeowners often wait too long until they're seeking assistance. Staff in the call center have been prompted to ask people, do you own your home or are you renting? And to begin the conversation about reaching out for counseling services. Back in September, when there was media about Acorn and predatory loan modification scams, many callers were suspicious of referrals to loan modification counseling and simply didn't want to engage. Through both projects, we've learned that callers are often reaching out for assistance for the first time, aren't quite sure what to expect and how to proceed. In addition, callers often reached out when they were deep into troubled circumstances. When we were developing messages for the local media campaign, we talked to the HUD-certified counseling agencies and heard the challenge of needing people to reach out early in the process and to help families understand they're not alone in their circumstances. The opportunity to communicate with lenders in a timely fashion is a consistent need among callers, and I would echo the recommendation to advocate for clear, consistent, and responsive communication from lenders. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Senator Girard?
The first question I would have deals directly with the incentive of the bank. Why do you think that banks do you think this is an intentional oversight, or do you think that that they are somehow gaining in the foreclosure process? Because everything that I have ever seen about foreclosure is the bank loses big. And I just kind of want to know what your feeling is about that, because I just don't get that sense that they don't want to renegotiate if there's any chance whatsoever that the loan modification would go through.
Madam Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, I can answer this to an extent. One of the things that we're aware of is that for loan servicers, the middlemen in this process, they actually have more incentive to foreclose than they do to do a loan modification. There's a report that I can provide to you that goes into a lot of depth on that. Part of it is that it costs them money to do the loan modification process, and if it's successful, since they make a percentage as a loan servicer of the amount of the loan, they'll end up getting a smaller percentage, you know, smaller amount of money from collecting the checks down the road. And without having to show that they're actually fully complying with the HAMP requirements, there's no way to be sure if they are being completely honest about the process and not just, you know, providing the, denying the loan modification request so they can continue collecting fees, et cetera, on a foreclosure process. Now, the banks themselves, that's part of what HAMP was set up to do, was say you need to do a net present value test that determines who, is it in the best interest for the banks. We're just asking to see those net present value tests. And see the work being done. Along the lines of your question, I think that there's also the factor that they've been overwhelmed. The banks have been overwhelmed with this whole process, and it's not necessarily intentional, but they do need to get it right. These are people's homes that we're dealing with, and so if it's just maybe taking more time to do all of this so they get it right, I think that's important for the homeowners.
Paula?
Yes.
Back on kind of the same train of thought, the major problem and what I see is that the real estate market has plummeted to such a degree that the value is not in the homes, even with some of these people have put 20% down. And that's why it behooves me to think that the banks are out there trying to be aggressive at trying to do foreclosures because it saturates the market. And that's similar to what's happened in Bend. The property values over there have plummeted, and that over on the coast. So, again, I just don't understand where the bank has incentive to be out there being too aggressive on a foreclosure.
Madam Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, I share your consternation with it. I don't understand it myself why there's so few loan modifications being offered and so many permanent modifications being offered. I've been trying to figure that out myself, and I will continue to try to figure that out.
Okay. One final question.
Sure, go ahead.
And this has to do, and I understand the frustrations of somebody going through a foreclosure. I mean, I'm going through tough financial times myself. Things just aren't pleasant. But I've also heard that certain groups have been promoting the idea that after the foreclosure seems inevitable, that the owner can go take the light fixtures, plumbing fixtures, building appliances, and basically vandalize the house. Please tell me that Osberg is not promoting that.
Madam Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, absolutely not. That is not something we would ever do. I've heard those same stories. I actually saw Michael Moore's movie that talked about that as well. That's absolutely nothing we would do. We're looking to solve this crisis in a way that keeps as many people in their homes as possible and benefits the lenders as well, so they can remain healthy institutions for our communities.
Senator George? Senator Rosenbaum?
Well, I do have a question. Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't think this is going to be fixed in February, unfortunately. I think a number of legislators and advocates wanted a stronger bill than the one that we ended up passing. But I guess, and this may be a question for you, it may be a question for the chair, whose job is it really at a state level to monitor even the sort of limited recourse that we have provided for the homeowner? And it's not very clear to me whose job that is. You know, if the things that you're telling us, you know, and I have no reason to question people who are sitting here who have lost or in the process of losing their homes, but if these things are even a fraction of them true, then clearly the intent of this law is not being followed. And it seems like, because this has been well documented at a national level, that there are lending institutions that are deliberately just, you know, for whatever reason, I'm not impugning anybody's motives, it's just not happening. So I guess really that is my question is, you know, is there an agency in the state of Oregon, whether it's the Department of Justice or the Department of Consumer and Business Services, that could start investigating cases, take complaints, and actually make sure that at least these protections are not being ignored or abused? I mean, when you call an insurance company or you call a credit card company, generally your telephone call is recorded. You're told that it's being recorded when you are waiting 10 minutes for somebody to actually get on the line. So I assume something like that is happening in these cases.
I don't hear a response from the panel. I do want to add that the remedy that's in Senate Bill 628 is that there's an affidavit that's filed by the trustee stating how, right, that's filed as public record stating how the lender servicer has complied with the provisions of the bill. And so if there hasn't been compliance, then that would cloud the title. So we are going to be hearing later in our hearing today from someone representing the Bankers Association and from someone representing the Mortgage Lending Association and the United Trustees Association about how that's working. I do want to mention when I listened to John's testimony about the people he's out there talking to, that I have had constituents contact me with very similar issues, primarily the multiple times sending documents and the inconsistent information. And I know that it is happening. And I agree with Senator Girard that there really isn't a logical reason for the banks to be doing that. And I'm looking forward to hearing testimony from their representative who we'll be hearing from later today. Any other questions for this panel? I believe we're going to skip for now over the next agenda item because the person who's testifying is not here yet, and that's access to legal representation for homeowners in foreclosure. And next we're going to hear from the counselors, the housing counselors. They're going to talk a little bit about what they do, how homeowners find them, and the response that they've been encountering when they're working with lenders. And we have Stacey Howard, Cheryl Roberts, and Ken Smith here as housing counselors to talk about their role in all of this. Thank you for being here.
We're going to wait on Carol because she's actually the first speaker.
Okay. So you've already figured out who's going first. You're ahead of us. Terrific. All right, welcome. If you'll start by stating, he'll start by stating your name for the record, please.
My name is Carol Berger. I'm sitting in for Cheryl Myers.
Okay.
Cheryl Roberts. I'm sorry. The director of African American Alliance for Homeownership. I apologize. She's sick today, and I'll be talking on behalf.
Thank you. Carol is your name, right?
Carol Berger.
Thank you, Carol. Okay, you want to go ahead?
Yes. African American Alliance, and, Madam Chair, I'm new to this, so please, I apologize for
no worries.
Doing it quite
if
right.
If you just pull the microphone over just a little bit. Terrific. Thank you.
If I'm not doing this quite right, I'm very new to this. My name again is Carol Berger. I'm the lead foreclosure counselor for African American Alliance for Homeownership. And we're a service, we provide a service to all our counselors, and the counselors out there in the state of Oregon provide a service for consumers that are in danger of losing or in foreclosure and danger of losing their homes. Whether the consumer lives locally or whether they're anywhere in the state, there are counselors out there to help them and provide them with several things. I've bulleted some items on the sheet that I've provided, and most of the help that they get can be anywhere from, and I'm just talking about focusing on foreclosures, can be from helping to assess their financial stability, being a neutral party, talking to the lender or the servicer, knowing that behind those lenders and servicers are investors that are also trying to coordinate everything, and that might give Senator Girard an idea of why there's so much, so many problems in trying to get people into a modified loan. There's so many hands involved and so many people involved when talking to a servicer or a lender. And so that becomes an important part of the counselor's part as being a neutral party to try to sort or ferret through all those people out there. The emotional support is what most of the people are looking for when they come in because they want somebody to sit down, listen, and understand their situation. And that's what we as counselors do. Statewide, we're there to help them figure out where they are so that we know where to go from there when we talk to the lender. That emotional support becomes very, very important because they can come in with not being behind, but they're current, but they're afraid of what's going to happen. Or they're in some process of collections or foreclosure, or they're even have their house has been auctioned, what do I do next? And so just as the lady from 211, I apologize, I forget her name, said that they're seeing a lot of people coming in needing help and getting support through them. And we also provide resources to the people, the consumer coming in, including the 211, the legal aid, and all the other resources that are out there. We make sure that they have that in front of them when they can leave. our service is free. We don't charge for the service. We provide resources to help them with employment and food, any other alternative housing if they are having to leave their house and how they're going to do that and how they're going to do that well. We provide referrals. If there's something that needs to be done that we can't provide them, we provide those referrals so that they can get the help they need. But we also maintain contact with them so that we can make sure that they're getting a solution to what they originally come in for. We also are getting referrals from many people. Our referrals that come from friends that have been there that are referring friends or neighbors. We also get referrals from lawyers. We get referrals from the bank themselves and the lenders themselves. We also have gotten referrals from other nonprofits in case one nonprofit's been getting somebody from Portland wanting to get service. People are on the internet and they're looking for whatever service they can get. A little bit about AWE, the African American Alliance last year, in the last quarter, saw 105 people that we are working on now, and during the year last year we saw 350. AWE is based in Portland, Oregon, but we get people from the coast. We get people from the other side of the river as well, which isn't a concern here with this board because of the bills that you're looking at. But we do get a huge amount of people. It makes it very stressful on our counselors because we just don't have the time to support all the people coming in from all the places. We get people from down in south of Salem, down in Turner. We get people from up in Mount Hood coming in. So we get people from a huge area. We are the front door to the resources that they need. Many of the people coming in don't know what resources are available. So when we are counseling them in foreclosure, we're also providing the resources that, from the story they've given us, that they may need. And any of the other resources, we offer them and ask them if that's something they need, and they can say yes or no. We do have four HUD-certified housing counselors that work at AWE. And our clients that reach us, again, have reached us through many avenues, including also Hope Now, and through the HUD website. Some of the people coming in have income. Some do not. Some have been in their homes for over 20 years or more, and they all want to try to keep their homes. And those that don't, we also provide the information they need to safely leave their home and not have the lender coming back at them for any of the funds that they didn't get from the home. And there's ways that they do that. So I hope that this helps a little bit in what you're... It's really brief. It's not a lot of information, but it's very brief and gives you an idea of what the counselors are facing. And the counselors, so what I'm seeing and what the other counselors in our office are seeing is that we don't have enough time to serve all the people. There's a huge amount. We're only seeing the tip of the iceberg out here right now. And we just need the funds to be able to support more counselors and get more counselors trained in this area.
Thank you. Carol, how does one become a HUD-certified counselor? What's that process involve?
There's training involved. NeighborWorks has training that we can send them to. There's also training that HUD can provide specifically for the FHA loans. There's webinar training that's offered as well with not just NeighborWorks, but other organizations that train specifically in foreclosure counseling. I've done a lot with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and with the NeighborWorks as far as webinars, and there have been the NeighborWorks classes as well as the FHA classes that HUD provides.
Thank you very much.
In addition to that, we've also had access to servicer-provided trainings. So we have had actually invited the servicers to give us some information from their perspective.
Terrific. And who's going next?
That would be me. I'm Ken Smith with Willamette Neighborhood Housing Services. We primarily serve Lynn and Benton counties. But because I speak Spanish, I've been covering other aspects of the state. We're going to kind of break up our testimony today in three different blocks, and I'm going to try to cover the lender response to foreclosure. This won't answer Senator Girard's questions by any means, but it will give you a perspective on that. Some of the same issues that the homeowners are dealing with, we as counselors, even though we think we have different portholes, are dealing with the same things. And I think there's a misconception of the use of the term lender. And nationally, it's become, I think, a big problem when it comes to foreclosure mitigation because lender has nothing to do with where they got their loan. It's been sold multiple times. It's now owned through the secondary market. It's now either owned by Fannie or Freddie, which would be great because the HAMP modification program works for them, or it's owned by some other independent investor that has very different regulations and rules about what can happen with that loan. And the servicers are dealing with all that. Just because Bank of America may have Fannie and Freddie loans doesn't mean they don't have these private investors as well. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate in Linn County that most of the loss mitigation issues that I'm dealing with are subprime loans. That should have never happened in the beginning. There's no reason for, in certain cases, why anybody should have got a subprime loan, especially with the Oregon bond available when it was. Now it's not, but, you know, that's one of the things. With great loan products, we shouldn't have this situation. Now, the number one reason for loss mitigation in the state of Oregon that we're dealing with the counselors, and we've heard it from testimony earlier, is job loss. So loss of income. That's the number one hardship. But let me back up. The servicer is trying to implement rules and regulations from every single investor. That's almost an impossible task, especially if they're not well-trained. And a lot of servicer shops and subprime servicers I'm dealing with are poorly trained in understanding what options are available. And if HAMP is the best program that we can use, and it's not available for all borrowers. So that's a problem right there. The second key issue with loss mitigation is availability of programs and implementation. So if Fannie and Freddie is an investor, they are looking to the servicers to make sure they're implementing HAMP, right? And we have a counselor hotline that we can call and say, look into this file for us, because we don't think the guidelines of HAMP is being used for this particular servicer, and we will get implementation and they will look at that case. So the Treasury Department has been very helpful through Fannie and Freddie to make that happen. So that's great for those that are eligible for HAMP, that are owned by Fannie and Freddie. Not so great for everybody else. And like in my area, most of those foreclosures are everybody else. The second issue is implementation. So servicers that are more well-trained understand, it's why we're getting that back and forth between, yes, you qualify, no, you don't qualify, because every time you call, you get somebody different with a servicer. Inherent problem right away. Not one person has that case file. It's passed on through a computer screen, and not every person that you called did their due diligence or wrote down the last conversation, which should have happened. And so the follow-through is not happening. They also, some of the small servicers, don't have a loss mitigation department. The ones that do sometimes do better with implementation of HAMP. But the ones that do not, we're getting back to collections. Yesterday, for example, I was on the phone. I had loss mitigation number, loss mitigation department. We have hotline numbers that we don't give to borrowers, numbers that we need to use as counselors to get through. I had that number. I'm in line. It got routed to collections. Collections cannot help me, right? But that's happening to borrowers and everyone else. They have the right number. They have a contact. They can't get there. Collections sent me back to the department. I waited again on the phone for 20 minutes. Finally got somebody, again, with no solution. No, we're at an impasse with this particular case because we don't have an answer from the investor about what can happen. And some of those problems are inherent of just working with a lot of different investors. And that's an implementation issue. I mentioned these key issues because they're the major platform for any foreclosure situation. So we're on a platform that's already rocky. And it makes it most frustrating for counselors because we have to deal with these different issues. It's just impossible to apply. It would be great if we could all deal with HAMP modification, say somebody qualifies for HAMP, do this trial mod, which should happen for everybody really quick. I don't know why it takes forever. I'm with you, Senator Girard. Shouldn't take forever. Do a trial mod, make sure they're making the payment, and finalize it, period, right? We can blanketly do that for people that have a serious hardship. But here's the problem with HAMP. Unemployment income does not count unless it's awarded for 9 months. State of Oregon awards unemployment for 6 months. Then there's renewals that can happen that get us well past 9 months, but initially doesn't apply. So unemployment, and this is the number one hardship in the state of Oregon, unemployment income, therefore, won't count in a modification. So state of Oregon is already hit by the federal HAMP program because we don't get unemployment awarded for 9 month times. Secondly, and I mentioned this briefly, Linn County majority of borrowers of subprime loans, Freddie and Fannie, do not buy subprime loans. So subprime loans are not owned by Freddie and Fannie. There's no HAMP. typically available for those people. Some private investors are now, through the incentives, taking advantage of applying HAMP to their portfolios because they're seeing major losses, but typically that wasn't available. Remember, HAMP has only been available since March of 2009. And it wasn't really implemented until recently. I mean, people were just trying to come up to speed with that, so we're just trying to see HAMP modifications now. I think that covers basically everything I wanted to cover today. I did want to make a point that the unemployment's a real issue in the state of Oregon just because of the way it's awarded. But in conclusion, there is a myriad of server and investor issues that contribute to the poor response, and I don't speak for them. And I'd be happy to fix their problems if they ask me, but they don't. And unfortunately, as HUD counselors, we can't break through all the barriers for every borrower we work with, and we are limited on the people we can serve. It's sad. I just can't serve everybody. In a case-by-case basis by servicer, we do what we can to get those ideas, those preconceived notions that the servicer had, try to correct implications, try to reinforce and send in everything we can to push our understanding of whether this borrower is going to succeed in any modification and try to make that happen. So we're doing everything we can to make it work for any servicer and any investor. But I think the best option for anyone in this stage is always education, to understand what the options are, to try to catch people early in the process. And we, as counselors, unfortunately, have seen people last minute. Even through the efforts of 211, that's changing a little bit. But even with the efforts of 211 and all the efforts that we put out with Senate Bill 628 and getting notices to people right at the notice of default, it's in there to call 211 SafeNet. They're still not getting to us. I think, you know, there's also this... Nationally, there's been problems where people have paid for service, loan modification services. I'm working with a lot of those folks. They paid $3,000 up front and got nothing happened, and they think we're the same entity, and we are not. And I think that's just not clear out there. So I will conclude with that. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to hear from Stacey, and then we'll take questions.
Senator Bonamici and members of the Senate Consumer Protection Committee, thank you for having us. My name is Stacey Howard, and I'm the Homeownership Director for the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation. We have offices in Lane County and Marion County. We are, among other things, a regional housing center and a HUD-certified housing counseling organization. I am also a HUD-certified foreclosure prevention counselor, and I've been doing this work since 2008. I've also served on some committees and panels statewide. The state of Oregon, I think, has been in many ways very proactive in trying to address some of the concerns around the foreclosure crisis and the collapse of the housing market. And I have worked on panels that included servicers, that included lenders, that included government agencies, municipalities, nonprofits, in trying to formulate some solutions and figure out exactly what the issues are. It's in my testimony, but I'm going to refer you to a public policy discussion paper that is put out by the Federal Reserve Bank of Oregon, and it's only one of many, and it's just one I happen to bring with me. But there are policy papers out that really help to identify what some of the reasons are that loans are not being modified, that are not initially clear to those of us on this end of things. I think the longer that I do this work, the more that I realize that we are in a very complex environment, and I don't have all the answers, and the more educated I become about the issues, the less I feel like I do have the answers. So I think when we try and simplify things, like, isn't it in the best interests of everyone to modify, the answer is no, it isn't. I mean, unfortunately, that's a truth. It is not always in the best interest, and it's because there's a lot of complex relationships that are interwoven out there, and one impacts the others in often ways that we cannot predict. So when we come up with solutions, we're often missing major pieces of the puzzle. When I work with people, I require, and let me say that I am the only HUD-certified foreclosure prevention counselor doing face-to-face counseling in either Lane or Marion County. Now, we recently did add some new staff people, but it's a little bit complicated to try and both do the work and train the new people, and it's going to be some time before they're able to do the work without quite a bit of supervision. So I hope that that helps to illustrate for you just how little resource there is in our community for people to get access to help. And although the Portland area is, I think, more generously populated with HUD-certified housing counselors, I think our number is less than 30 for the entire state. And I think if you look at total FTE, the last number that I saw was 22 for the state of Oregon. So when I work with people, I require that they come to a two-hour workshop, and I think nearly all of us do something similar. And if they don't come to the workshop, they don't get an appointment with me. And in that workshop, I'm covering a lot of information, teaching them what about the environment they're in, about the contract that they're in, and about how to do the analysis. But I'm also letting them know the system is broke. I mean, there's just no question but what the system is broke. And so I can give them all the information in the world, but I cannot tell them, if you do this and you do it correctly, this will be the logical outcome from that. And that is part of the inherent difficulty in this situation, is that I have to touch cases over and over and over and over again, because there's no predictable, identifiable and verifiable outcome for people, or a predictable path. And that makes it very difficult to ever resolve cases. And that means that there are just a few of us. And those few of us that there are do not have the capacity that we could have because of the inherent problems in the system. That said, I really want to emphasize that I do think that all the players involved, for the most part, are trying to do the right thing. And I'm talking about the homeowners, I'm talking about the nonprofit organizations, the municipalities, and the servicers and the lenders. I don't think that most entities set out to do shoddy work. Definitely myself included. And with the workload that I have, I'm sure I make mistakes. I have to. I just don't see how I could not make mistakes. And I can't always identify the mistakes that I make, but I know that they're out there because they have to be. And so, you know, we have that problem inherent in all levels of this discussion. I would say that given all that, there are still some things that we could do. And so I'm just going to outline a couple of things. Many of the servicers and investors comply only to the degree absolutely mandated by law. So I was told by someone at IndyMac the other day, we're no longer considering anyone for any loss mitigation options other than HAMP. When the administration implemented the HAMP program, they specifically said this is only going to help 20 to 25% of affected homeowners. It was never intended to be a program for everyone. So to say we're only going to consider people for HAMP modifications puts 80% of the potential problems out in the cold. Now, I think that person probably was not well trained and didn't know what they were talking about. But this is symptomatic of the kind of misinformation that gets put out there by servicers. I think that because of issues like the cost of redefault rates, the hidden costs of the potential cure rates, so some people will self-cure if nothing is done, and when that doesn't happen, it's a loss to the servicer. And I really can't speak intelligently about many of these issues, but these are issues that I wasn't even aware existed 6 months ago. So we're all coming up to speed, and I think I'm not the only one that's gradually learning more and more information about the complexities of this situation. A study of the, so that's enough about some of those issues, but what I would say is that if the servicers do not early on give accurate information to the homeowners and to the HUD-certified counselors, we are hamstrung. There is no action that we can take, because if you're faced with losing your home, you can't make an intelligent decision without accurate information. And so really, to hold the servicer accountable that, okay, you're there and you are doing a calculation, we want to document and verify the calculation, and we want to be able to verify the accuracy of the information that you used, to the extent that it's information that the homeowner can impact. So maybe they can't argue what redefault rates are for their area of the country or what the time the house sits on the market is, but they can certainly argue the home's value or the income used or the expenses used and the calculations that go into that. Because we're not given that information accurately from the servicer, how they arrived at their conclusion, we can't rebut it. In addition, servicers have to be held accountable. So when they say the investor won't modify, I want to know who the investor is, and I want to see the clause in the contract that says that the servicer or this investor refuses to modify. And I think that's a reasonable expectation given the room for error. If we were working in an environment where the error rate was extremely low, that might be an unreasonable request, but we're not in that environment. A study by the Irvin Institute says that homeowners who receive HUD-certified housing counseling advice are 60 times more likely to have a positive outcome, either a reduced payment or to avoid foreclosure. That said, you aren't going to get enough of us. HUD's not going to send out enough funding. There is not going to be some magical infusion of qualified people into the field to meet the demand. We're expected to have about 70,000 potential foreclosures in the state of Oregon between 2009 and 2012. You're not going to get enough people in the industry when the total now is less than 30 to work with all those homeowners. So as communities, we have to develop a system for intervention that does not rely strictly on nonprofits with limited funding providing all of the intervention. And so I think community responses, I don't know if you're all familiar with the events that happened in the city of Portland, in the city of Medford, but they were very successful in meeting a large number of people in a very timely manner and having some identifiable outcomes in a very short order. In addition to that, I think providing people who can train faith-based organizations, AARP and some of the other groups like that, that might be willing to take on some of the analysis and evaluation. The quality may not be there, but it may be better than nothing. And I think even among our fields, you're going to get varying quality. So we can't necessarily expect perfection, but we can expect a response. Homeowners misunderstand information, they rely on anecdotal information by friends, and they fall prey to the inflated claims of for-profit equity purchasers and foreclosure counselors. In order to reach homeowners in a timely manner with accurate information, I don't see any way that we can do anything other than have statewide PSAs out there that educate people, and that it's a unified and blanketing approach to getting information out to people about what the situation is that they're faced with and what the possible outcomes are and what the factors are that impact that. Now, that costs a lot of money in the state of Oregon. Oregon doesn't have the money. The nonprofits don't have the money. And I think that the HUD-certified housing counseling organizations, the government or entities, the nonprofits in general are doing a lot of work that is entirely benefiting the servicing industry and the investors. And they need to come to the table with some funds to get the word out and provide the training and partner with us more effectively to prevent. I mean, if we can prevent people, I deal with a reasonable number of people. Maybe it's 5%, maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 15%. I don't really know. But I deal with a reasonable number of people who had information early on, they may never have gotten behind because they would have made other choices. Had they understood that they were going to lose their home because for whatever reason they weren't eligible for a modification, they might not have made that choice in the beginning to get behind. And we need to get that information out to people. We owe that to people to do that. I know I've taken a long time, and I thank you for your patience.
Thank
and
you
I think
so
I'll
much.
Stop there.
Thank you for your testimony, and we will take some questions. I do want to clarify for those who may not have been here during the February 2008 session. We did pass a bill. It was House Bill 3630, and I know many of you in the room worked on that bill that deals with the equity purchasers and foreclosure consultants. So there is a remedy out there if there are those people out there making misrepresentations about they can save someone's home. There are some pretty strict requirements in that statute. And then also in this past session, I think Lou has left the room, but we did pass, I believe it was House Bill 2191 that requires registration for people who are in the business of helping people with modifications and debt management. So between those two bills, there should be at least some, hopefully people are learning about those and they're able to tell which are the legitimate nonprofit people who are either HUD certified or those who are offering valid advice versus those who are out there to make money off someone else's misfortune. So any suggestions that you have about how we can, because I know, Ken, you said that sometimes people were hesitant to call because they weren't sure they were getting the companies that were really going to help them. We certainly welcome any suggestions that anyone has about how we can help inform constituents and others about how to find someone who's really going to offer valid assistance. Senator Girard, I guess I should start with you and the questions.
Huh? Oh, yeah. I'm usually good for a couple. This is Ken. I want you to know that your summation, I agreed, it was kind of, you hit the nail on the head, but it was a little bit of a glancing blow. So I'm going to put my spin on it and give you a chance to kind of. The subprime loan, I really honestly feel, wasn't the cause of the problem. Now, probably one of the very few in this world that doesn't think that was the problem. And I do believe that subprime loans elevated the percent of ownership in this state to a level that's been unprecedented. The problem, I think, is what you alluded to, was the bundling of the subprime loans and being sold on the secondary market. So therefore, every bank had no reason not to sell subprime loans because they were working within their fiduciary responsibility, whereas the mega banks, Washington Mutual being one, just overloaded on subprime loans, which then made it vulnerable and caused the banking collapse. So, but I do think that I hate to see the fact that we eliminate the whole idea of subprime loans, because I think it was a very good tool to help people that could not afford homes get into homes during the times that they were implemented. It was only during the end towards the collapse that we had a problem. So I'll give you a chance to put your spin on that.
Well, thank you, and I do tend to agree somewhat with that. But I believe that subprime lending is an education problem. Most people have to get a subprime loan because their credit score doesn't allow them prime market. Credit scores can be fixed. HUD Counseling Elderly gives credit counseling all the time as a free service. The second thing is, I think a lot of people got subprime lending because they want the house now and not wait the 3 months it takes to repair credit. So inherently, I think the subprime market is a viable tool for the right people. I think there were from a borrower's point of view, people that got into subprime loans that didn't know what they were getting. As a HUD counseling service, you know, I was a pre-purchase counselor. I'm a HUD foreclosure counselor now. My job has changed fully. We have someone still in pre-purchase, but I would like everybody to get pre-purchase counseling, and not just for first-time homebuyers. I'm talking about refinances. A lot of the problems we've had recently dealt with refis. They had fixed-rate mortgage, excellent product, and I'm talking specifically about Linn County, and now in two loans, first and second, both subprime, both typically adjustable, or the first being fixed and the second adjustable. And I don't think it's an inherent problem of the product itself. I think it's just how it was marketed and who got it. And then the secondary market is a whole different bailiwick. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you that there were a lot of problems on the secondary market that creates to where we're at today. But in job loss, what's happening is those servicers don't have the authority to apply HAMP, and so we're getting not a lot of options and workout solutions for those particular products, and that's why I mentioned it. Not that I think the product itself is a problem, because I do think all those inherent problems, even the no-doc loans that worked for somebody self-employed, was really their only option. I mean, if we look at the tightening of lending today, and I speak as a lender because we are a lender. We do down payment assistance programs and lending for low-income buyers. And to get those low-cost products for the right borrower is great, and some people can't afford that, so they're getting other products. And I think it's a problem that can't be addressed by Senate Bill 628, but there is an inherent problem of education that is lacking, I think, for all borrowers in knowing what they got. And I would like to see, and we offer this service, free good faith estimate and truth in lending overview, so people know exactly what they think they're getting when they go to sign at the closing table. But thank you.
Many of us have been advocating better civic and personal financial education for month after month. Mm-hmm. Did you have a follow-up?
I do. And I kind of want to throw out another idea to you. And this is where I see the problem in the mortgage market. And it goes back to the secondary markets. And what I'm seeing is that banks wanting to unload higher-risk loans are selling at a fraction of the cost of the loan to a secondary purchaser, who a lot of people would think would be, they could be predators. And that to me is where the real problem lies, in that if the predator is able to buy something cheap enough that it's in his interest or her interest to foreclose, then that can be what's really generating a lot of the problem. So I just wanted your comment on that as well.
I agree absolutely. This is a risk-based market, so somebody willing to take the risk because the price allows that, right? So this is market pricing that allows a greater risk, and then the borrower gets caught in that catch-22, and they didn't have any say in how that happened, and that's unfortunate to the consumer. That really becomes a consumer problem, even if it wasn't generated at that level. I mean, I have ideas about loan products, so we would have never gotten this problem, mm-hmm. that we could start implementing today, but I haven't had a lender take it on. I mean, there's no reason we are limited now, mostly, for most people, to 20% down or you can't buy a house, okay? Market is down quite a bit, right? The issue isn't necessarily 20% product, because even if you got 80% loan and 20% down and the market went down, you still could be upside down, right? It's not going to make you make the payment. The issue is security. So if people had a reserve fund that was required, that was held by the bank instead of some of this private mortgage insurance and other things, it's also part of the problem. A reserve fund, they go ahead and borrow 100%. I don't care. But they hold 10% reserve, and that money is drawn upon when they get a situation, a personal situation, like loss of job. They would not affect their credit score. They would not be behind a payment. And that reserve could support 12 months of payments. If we did that sort of thing, we wouldn't have a problem today with a sort of hiccup in unemployment. And because the loss is unemployment, right? Now, Bank of America is pushing a new product. I just heard them the other day, called self-insurance, where the borrower pays extra to get self-insurance instead of paying private mortgage insurance. This isn't that different than their product that they want to push, except that benefits the bank and this benefits the consumer. So I think some of these issues are market-driven on a level that doesn't affect the consumer, and the consumer doesn't have a say.
Ken, I had a question about the unemployment. Do you happen to know where Oregon, and Senator Rosenbaum might know this? You talked about how unemployment doesn't count in Oregon because it's only awarded for 6 months and you need 9 months. Do other states, are we an anomaly? Are we the only state that awards unemployment for 6 months? Or is that the typical, and are states moving to 9 months? Does anybody know that? Do you know the answer?
Well, I was going to ask the same question, actually, because Oregon's unemployment benefits are generally considered way above average compared to other states, and in fact, the level of the benefits themselves are certainly place us higher than most other states. I mean, some states are just unbelievably low for the maximum benefit. So I wasn't aware of this issue about the initial 6 months. Is you're approved for 26 weeks, but nobody could say, even if it were 6 months, you couldn't say that you were going to have that income for the whole 6 months, because if a job is offered to you, you have to accept it. And so I don't really fully understand how that fits into this 9 month requirement. So I did have the same question. I don't know if other states are typically approving for longer than
with
that.
With multiple people, I'll let Stacy.
I've done a little bit of studying about this issue, and so what I recently found out, and I can't quote the policy paper because I see so many of them, and I didn't happen to earmark it and bring it here, but I did see something that came out with HAMP-specific guidelines. And you have to remember, HAMP is not everything. You're talking about 20 to 25% of the loans in trouble. That said, unemployment should be considered, including extensions. The problem is that with many of the servicing guidelines that come down, so Fannie and Freddie send down a guideline and they say this is what should be considered, and then there's this delivery system. One of the things that I read lately was that, for example, I think it was City Mortgage had to go from 400 loss mitigation personnel, and this is the person appraising the loan to see if it's going to be considered for modification, to 4,000. Bank of America has added something like 11,000 staff. So training is an issue with the servicers. If I'm having trouble training three people, I can imagine what it's like to train 11,000. So when it gets down to the service delivery, the person on the other end of the phone doesn't necessarily have that information. And it doesn't go out very effectively. I just found it out, and I work very hard to keep up to date on this. So I was not aware that there was an expectation that they would consider extensions. I have seen unemployment award letters from Alaska and some Midwestern state that I can't remember. Those award letters were for 12 months. So in that case, it's immaterial because it's a 12-month award letter. But our award letter is specifically for 6 months. Although in the HAMP guidelines, apparently there is a clause that says they're supposed to consider extensions. I have never seen that in actual practice. And in fact, many servicers will not consider unemployment income regardless of whether or not they're supposed to consider for HAMP modifications. So it's very difficult to get that income. And even though I have to say, in the current economy, unemployment is just as sure an income as a job. We could all lose our jobs tomorrow.
May I add?
Yes, go ahead, and then Senator George.
6 months is the unemployment, plus you get an extension for 13 weeks and another extension for 13 weeks. So overall, we're well above 9 months. And if the servicers don't implement it, that really is where the problem lies. The other thing goes back to risk. So lenders were out risking loans initially without a lot of documentation, without a lot of paperwork. But when it comes to modifications, they're trying to take very little risk. And so they're saying unemployment is risky income, and we won't really look at it. Now, I have multiple examples, I think we all do, where all the person needs is a modification of $200 a month for a temporary stance. Their unemployment income well supports that, the rest of their expenses. They've never been in default with a lender before. In fact, they may have this loan with a lender for over 10 years without any issues at all, yet the servicer and the investor is unwilling to modify. And that becomes a very difficult situation and why frustrations are really high in this market, because it doesn't seem on a cursory level like that should ever happen, that somebody that long as a payer, regular payment, and once they get a job again, will make that again, even if their income is less, they have means to make that happen. Because a lot of unemployment, even though it's a great benefit in Oregon, is still significantly less than what they were making in their job. It does not make sense on a cursory level.
Thank you.
And Senator George, did you have another question?
I did have a brief one, but I can wait. So,
yeah.
And I wanted to welcome Stacy back because she spent her whole day with Senator George and me since you were at our hearing this morning and Commerce and Workforce Development. But I think my more general question is just because you've all talked about the shortage of HUD certified counselors or just people who are qualified to do this kind of counseling. So are retired people, I mean, there's great programs using retired people of all sorts to help people as tax preparers or qualify for earned income tax credits, things like that. Are retired people or any other group a source of volunteer help who can get this training and then pitch in?
What I can answer part of that. Excuse me. We do have a retired person working with us as she answers. Our biggest problem is we have so many phone calls coming in, and our phones ring off the hook. She does the phone call, she does triage, she does intake, and then she passes it on so that the actual intake person can call the people back and set the appointment. So our pre-purchase people have become now intake specialists for foreclosure, but we have this one person doing nothing but answering phone calls, and it's been just, that's been the biggest help at all, and she's from a SMS program in Portland area, and gets paid through SMS, not through our organization. So there are places for retired people to come in and help.
I think that the issue is that we don't have someone who has time to put the programs together, and, I talk to people every day that have great ideas about how it could happen. It's just implementation of those kinds of service delivery mechanisms are something that I'm very passionate about. There's no way that I could put that on my plate. You know, I go home at night and I'm just this mass of exhausted jelly, and my family thinks that I don't exist. We're swamped. And, you know, I'm the homeownership director. Foreclosure prevention counselor is not in my title. Ken is the senior loan officer. Foreclosure prevention counselor, not in his title. So we already have other jobs that we're expected to perform on and that we do with varying degrees of success because of the level of things on our plate. So, yeah, there's lots of things we could do. We need the freedom to respond.
We also, I want to remind you, are going back up on the agenda to the access to legal representation from the Oregon State Bar shortly. But first we have a question from Senator George.
Two quick questions, if I could, Madam Chair. Stacey, in your concluding comment, just so you were ending, you said something interesting to me, and I was trying to figure it out. You said that people would default on their contract with the bank, on their mortgage, even though they could have afforded to pay, continue to pay. Is there some belief out there that defaulting on the contract with their bank benefits them in a foreclosure? Is that what's going on here?
Well,
and because that seems to be,
I think that you have a couple of things going on. So one is that they hear about their neighbor that got a great modification at 3% and they want to get on business, and they call up and they get told, well, you're current on your loan, so you're not eligible, without hearing the rest of the story. So they think, oh, well, I'll just pay off all my credit card bills with my money, and then I'm going to be eligible for this great loan because, you know, I'm at 7.5% and interest rates are now at 4% and I can't refinance for many reasons. So there is some of that. However, I do believe in my experience, which is not scientifically representative maybe, I see very few of those. That's really a small minority. What is more likely is that they have $4,000. They have $5,500 in expenses. Their house payment is $1,500. So they go, okay, well, there's these modification programs out here, and so maybe we can get a modification, but in the meantime, I better pay off my car, pay off my credit card accounts, pay, you know, my kids' braces bill. Because there's help out there, but the credit card companies won't work with me, my car loan company won't work with me, and they're accurate because I have them make all those phone calls, and every once in a while I will assist them, although very rarely, and they won't, there really is very limited willingness on other consumer debt to do anything. So people make the choice that makes sense to them. However, if they knew that that choice was going to cost them their home, they'd let the dentist go hungry. They would forget about the credit card payments. They would forego the car payments.
But they would prioritize their home over those other things, which is a more stabilizing choice for the family in many situations. In some situations, it's still not the best choice, which is where the analysis comes in. But
follow-up question.
Go ahead.
So I guess this is for the entire panel and probably for the previous panel. If we have 70,000 foreclosures that are going to happen in the next 2 years, there's a huge portion of those that just could never qualify whatsoever for a loan modification. Are those people coming into the system trying to get modifications because they want to hang on to their home? And is that bogging down at the front end? Is there a pre-screen process to say, hey, there's just no way you're even close? Just you're done. You've violated the contract. You don't have any ability to fulfill your contract with the bank. Therefore, you know, the bank's going to foreclose. And just get them out of the system right away? Are you guys just bogging down with those people who you think could qualify? And why isn't there why isn't there a simple math equation saying, here, take this. If you come out with a positive number at the end, then we'll even talk to you. How does that pre-screening process work?
You'll have to ask the servicers about the NPV tool.
Okay.
I think I'll speak just as housing counselor. We have gone to a group session just so people realize they're not the only person I'm working with.
Gotcha.
Right? That the whole room is full. And to try to get, I would say less than a third of everyone I'm working with will actually go to modification. Mm-hmm. Everything else has a different solution that sometimes happens quicker. Mm-hmm. So if they do come to a HUD housing counseling agency, we're trying to process them with a solution that works for them and tell them their options right up front. That's really what we're doing in the workshop.
Gotcha.
What are your options and what tests can you do to see if you're going to qualify for any modification? Then those that have all the right parameters, we will work with on a modification, or if they have the capability to do it on their own, I'll direct them to work with the servicer directly to do it on their own, and if they have any hiccups or problems, to come back to us. But we're trying not to do this for everybody. We can't.
So just follow up real quickly, Madam Chair. So you are only, you're, the frustrations you all have been talking about with actually interactions with the financial institutions are with people from your perspective that have hope of
qualifying.
Okay. That's what I was
absolutely
trying to get. I was kind of caught off guard by what you said earlier.
Why my argument about accurate information early on in the process, because we can't always identify early on who may or may not be eligible because we lack adequate information. We don't have a fully utilized NPV tool like the servicer does, and we don't get that feedback back in a timely manner. Also, some investors sometimes there is an investor guideline that says, we're not going to modify this loan. And again, we don't get that. It may be 7 or 8 months before we finally go through this whole process and find, oh, well, that loan was never eligible for modification.
Gotcha.
We wasted an enormous amount of time.
I got you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
May I say something as well? At all, we don't go through the orientation process. We do our stuff a little bit differently. Everybody that comes to our doors gets to see a counselor, and we do that because we want to create a triage where we know what's going on and what, if we need to refer them, we refer them out. If we need to do something else to get them safely out of the house or to provide them with other resources that are not the HEMP or the HARP program, we do that with them. It's a good process because everybody's getting help that way, and so that's how we operate, and it works out quite well for everyone, and it shows in our numbers the amount of people that are coming through. We just wish that we could help as many people as possible. Like much like what Stacy says, we do run into same problems that on the lender end, and that's where we get bogged down. Is the lender is promising a lot of things, and then all of a sudden, the negotiators are gone, the lender's gone, nobody wants to answer questions, and so we get that on occasion.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That was very helpful. We're going to take just about a 4-minute break. Please don't go too far. I'm going to close.